I'm originally from Mobile, Alabama. I literally lived my childhood, adolescence, early adult life in Mobile. I went to high school there. I went to a school that was first integrated. It was one of the biggest high schools in Mobile, and it was integrated around 1971. And when it was integrated, that was a race riot. Both my twin sister and my older brother were arrested. I found the time to walk home with my girlfriend during the riot. So that's another story there. But, yeah, I'm from Mobile, Alabama, born and raised, and lived in a segregated neighborhood. Didn't really have any problem with white people because we stayed on our side of town. They stayed on their side of the town. And I don't have a lot of bad memories of interacting with whites, with the exception of one time I was walking over my aunt's house and we had to go through a white neighborhood, and we were both on the same sidewalk. And I was walking toward the white couple, and they had a German Shepherd dog with them. And as I got closer, they said the dog wouldn't bite. And then when I got close to them and I passed them, and the dog bit at my butt, and if I didn't, he really, literally ripped a hole in my shirt. It's sort of like one racial incident that I recall. But other than that, I mean, you know, I had a pretty good life. I don't really have anything bad to say about Mobile. I did march in 1968 after Martin Luther King was assassinated. I remember that. In 68, I was 12 years old. So that's my earliest remember of sort of like being a part of a movement, if you will, and stuff like that. I mean, I could say more, but I'll stop there.
And Kevin, how about yourself?
Sure. Thank you for sharing that, Ron. I have a much different experience growing up a white man in West Seneca here, close to Elma. And my upbringing did not include a lot of diversity. I went to Queen of Heaven School, a private Catholic school, then Canisius High School, then Canisius College. And other than one friend whose father was from India, that was about the only diversity I encountered until I got to high school, where black students were really in the minority, maybe one to every 100 students there. So, yeah, my upbringing was didn't give me too many challenges along the way until I reached Canisius College, and things really changed there, where I spent 6 weeks in El Salvador, 3 weeks in India, a few months in Germany. And that was an opportunity, multiple opportunities, to sort of change my perception of the world and everything else. And I think just some quick lessons learned there. You know, you're able to, when you travel, you pull out the best in people, and you can sort of break down to the lowest common denominator. You see people who you knew nothing about, and just like you, they're sort of seeking comfort and happiness and better outcomes for their children. And I think when you start there and you can find those similarities with people around the world, it's a lot easier to find those similarities with people in your own neighborhoods and in your own cities.
And Kevin, when people talk about white privilege, what does that mean to you? Have you seen it? Can you give any examples of it?
Sure. I would say, first of all, that white privilege is real. I think if you're asking for what it means to me, I think it's a simple definition would be that, you know, as a white person, you may experience success or failure in life, but your skin color is not really one of those obstacles that stands in the way of either of those destinations, as it is so often for our friends and peers of color. And I think as a complex definition of white privilege, you know, you enter the world in a 7 billion person lottery, and it's realizing how lucky I was to be born a white male in the United States. And so when you can realize that is a gift given to you right off the bat, and how that plays out in your life, where you receive the benefit of the doubt more often than your black peers. You benefit from generational wealth accumulated by white people in our society and in this region that was often stripped from black communities due to redlining here in Buffalo, due to hiring and financial discrimination, I think if you realize you've been given a gift, then you're going to start taking your first steps toward working to give that gift back and realize that you owe something to society. So, yeah, I think that once you've realized that you benefit from white privilege, then the next step is to just listen more, read more, not just headlines, but full articles and books. And, you know, you can begin to try to empathize with Black people in your own community, in your own country, and what they're going through in 2020 and what they've been enduring for 400 years here. And I would just add that white privilege is also being able to walk away from all this. You know, when people say, I don't engage in politics, I don't engage with social justice, that in itself is privilege, to be able to say, oh, no, I don't get into that, because it clearly, the oppression of our society doesn't affect you and gives you the opportunity to walk away from all of it. So as I said, it's simple and complex, but it is certainly a real thing.
And Ron, on your end, what does white privilege mean to you?
Well, it essentially means that from the smallest minute activity, micro level to macro level actions, whites can do things and get away with that I cannot. You know, I can't, you know, I can't drive my car in Amherst, New York, any time of the night without the thought of not being pulled over by a police officer, searched, and stuff like that. To attending a predominantly white university, working on a master's degree or a PhD, and not having to worry about my race impacting whether or not I will have a great experience in graduate school or I will have a horrible experience. And I'm talking from personal experiences. I've been stopped in Amherst. I'm a college professor. My car searched to, like, they literally took the spare tire out and lifted up the thing in the trunk and all that kind of stuff. And when I was a graduate student at The Ohio State University, I experienced something that I know that I should not have. So white privilege affords whites opportunities on all levels, and no same opportunities will not be afforded to me. And you name it, whites are advantaged and blacks are disadvantaged. And that's what white privilege means to me.
And Ron, how long have you lived in Buffalo?
I lived in Buffalo since 1990. I came here August the 25th, 1990. I think that's the night I moved in on Saturday night, Sunday morning, and I started teaching at Buffalo State. My contract started September the 1st, 1990, and this September the 1st, I'll start my 31st year of teaching at Buffalo State College. But I would like to share something with you that I received probably during my second or third year in Buffalo. Probably my second or third year in Buffalo. I don't know, back then there was a movement in society where you had these black conservatives. You know, you had people who were blacks who were identifying as conservatives. And so the Buffalo News did an article about that movement, and they called and asked me some questions. I think the guy's name was Delante. He was the reporter. And I just told, it was like on maybe a Thursday. It might have showed up that Friday or something in the article where they quoted me. And so I came to work that Monday or Tuesday, and I had a letter in my mailbox. This is the letter I received. This was what I call my welcome to Western New York letter. And I'm going to read it to you. The letter is probably 25, 27 years old, but to me, it's like it happened yesterday. And I'm going to read. You mind if I read it?
Not at all.
Okay. It says, Ron, you fucking filthy nigger. You expected utopia. Do you know how many highly intelligent but abused as children whites there are on the welfare rolls? It's not just little turd on two legs Sambos, boy. So this is the promised land for everyone but jitterbug and shitkins, eh? Go back to South Africa, coonhead spade. Find utopia in an isolation cell there, shadow boy. And then the person said, yeah, I got the nerve. And they put their name, address, and everything on the letter. On the left margin, they write, going sort of like vertical, they write, P.S., is the inner cheeks of your ass light like your palms and soles? Just curious. And to the top right, they draw a picture of the Ku Klux Klan, like one of the masks, and then they say, spade, spade, and a nig, a filthy shit skin. This was my welcome to Western New York. Person lives on Brompton Wood Street in Amherst. They also gave their name, but I won't say. Now, I reported this to the Buffalo State Police Department. They went to this house. The guy literally lived at that house, but he wasn't home, and his mother said that he didn't write this letter. And that was the end of it. I will say this. The New York State Department of Human Rights got involved with it because this was kind of like I came here. I had a wife and three kids who were 2, 4, and 6. And so I was a young family moving to a strange land. I come from the bottom of the United States, Mobile all the way up to the top in Buffalo. And so this has always informed my perceptions of Western New York, my perception of whites in the North. And it's something that I'll never forget. I'll never live it down. It's the words and the language that were used in this letter were stuff I had never heard, never seen before, like shit skins and coon head spade. I never seen stuff like this down south. And like I said, I left Mobile when I was an adult, going off to Ohio State University to get 2 master's degrees.
Just as an aside, can you compare North racism in the North to racism in the South?
You know what? You know, I think people like to say that racism in the South is more virulent, but I think this subtle implicit racism, it digs deeper and it hurts more because it's you know it's there, but people act like it's not. Whereas down south, you know it's there, and everybody knows it is. And you peacefully coexist, you get along, and that's sort of like it. But in New York, like if you go out in Amherst, I've been to some I've seen Confederate flags in Amherst and stuff like that, and you don't expect to see that kind of stuff. And a lot of people, unless you go in those neighborhoods. I mean, I was looking to buy a car. Someone had a car for sale, and I went out there, and the car was in one yard, but next door to that yard was a house that had a Confederate flag. So Northern, I tell you, like Malcolm X said, that the South is anything below the Canadian border. And so racism is racism. I don't care if it's in the South, the North, the East, or the West. It is what it is. And in Western New York, cannot escape it. It cannot run from it. It is alive and well. Like, for example, when the mall was open, Galleria Mall, I used to go out to the mall and just observe how all of these stores wouldn't have any black sales associates. And you go to a lot of these restaurants now, today, you don't see any diversity. Most of the wait staff and many of the nice restaurants in Buffalo are all white, period, zero. And so I think that says a lot about Western New York. Whereas if you go down south, you see blacks working everywhere. So it's a serious problem in the North, Western New York. People don't like to talk about it, but it's alive and well. I don't go to South Buffalo. I don't know how to get I couldn't even find my way down there. And I've been here 30 years, and I don't want to find my way down there. Yeah, it's just the way it is.
It's interesting that you mentioned South Buffalo because last summer I was interviewing a husband and wife in South Buffalo, and I was just walking around their neighborhood, and I just happened to turn one down one street, and there's a Confederate flag like four houses down. And it's just amazing how, like, this is supposed to be a pretty progressive state, but, you know, you don't even have to leave the city to find stuff like that. Kevin, I want to ask you how much working for the Rise Collaborative, how much interaction do you have with people of other races on a daily basis?
Sure. I think Rise has allowed me more opportunity to do so than I would have in other careers. I came from advertising here in Buffalo, two different agencies, and that is notoriously a very whitewashed industry. Very hard to find diversity there. And that's also strange because of how much of Black culture we've appropriated and enjoy that we don't have people of color in creative agencies at the same time. So that's a problem Buffalo also needs to deal with. But with Rise Collaborative, we're independent media, and we find ourselves covering the arts quite a bit. And I would say that Buffalo is very fortunate to have many Black artists here in multiple mediums, but a lot of what we cover is visual and performing arts, and a little bit of music as well. So that has gotten me some great opportunities to collaborate on some projects with males and females, African American, and we also do a lot of work with nonprofits, and with Buffalo being an impoverished city, and unfortunately, you know, a lot of these nonprofits are dealing with our neighbors who are in East Side neighborhoods and things like that too. But fortunately, they have put Black people into some leadership positions in those organizations. And we've gotten to, we produced our first newspaper with Open Buffalo, who does a lot of work to advance those causes. And then we've incorporated a lot of writers of color, a lot of video subjects of color. So I don't think if I wasn't doing what I'm doing with Rise now, I would have those opportunities, because it seems so many industries in this town are lacking diversity in so many ways. But it also helps us keep our ear to the ground. In a lot of ways, we think we see this coming, that there's more, you know, diversity and inclusion movements coming from organizations. It's just they're receiving the training, they're receiving the awareness. We're hoping to see that turn into action. But I'll leave it at that, that Rise, through the arts and through our coverage of nonprofits, it has given us some good opportunity to do interaction and collaboration.
And Ron, you probably, as a professor, have interactions with people of different races on a daily basis.
Yeah. I don't. One thing I'm very adamant about when I'm dealing with students, I don't see color. In fact, oftentimes I can connect with white students better than I could with a lot of Blacks, because oftentimes the Black students think that I'm asking, requiring more of them, and which I'm not. You know, I'm very well liked on campus. I have been described or characterized as the most popular professor on campus. I've received the Professor of the Year Award a couple of times from United States government. And then in terms of my colleagues, right now I'm the chair of this department, and I go, when we have chairs meeting, it's about 15 of us, and I'm the only Black in the room, and that kind of stuff disturbs me in terms of just interacting with colleagues. But I tend to get along with everybody from the maintenance staff all the way up to the president. You can't say Ron Stewart and people don't know who I am, because, like I said, I've been here 30 years and I've educated thousands of Western New Yorkers. I have mentored white students who've gone on and got their PhDs, particularly white females, and I've mentored Black males and Black females. So I tend to I don't see color. I'll just put it that way. In terms of my profession, I could leave race at the door when I walk into the room, in terms of dealing with students. But when I deal with colleagues, I got colleagues who don't speak to me, and I don't speak to them. I don't have any problems in treating people the way they treat me. And I don't aspire to be anywhere what I'm not wanted. I'm just not one of those kind of people that want to be around people who don't want me to be around them. You don't speak to me, I don't speak to you. And so, but I don't initiate it, but when I make the observation, I can put you on the same list you got me on. And so, but I've enjoyed teaching at Buffalo State. It is a very diverse college. Perhaps Buff State talks about finding its niche. I think it should aspire to become New York State's only historically black college or university. But that's my personal opinion right there. I know we get a lot of pushback, but SUNY does need a historically black college within the 64 colleges and stuff like that. But that's neither here nor there. So, yeah, I get along with people, and I love people, and people love me.
But for speaking from the perspective of a black man, what do you think you don't understand about white people in America or in Buffalo?
I just don't understand why can't whites get over this racial intolerance? Why can't they just let it go? You know, I look at biracial children. This might be kind of crude, but it makes the point. I look at biracial children. Most biracial children are nice-looking children, if you will. You know, you rarely see, like, just bear with me. You rarely see ugly biracial children. And what does that say?
Well, as a biracial person, I want to thank you for that.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I knew. I remember that from the when I met you at that other.
Yes, sir.
Yeah. But my point is, if you can naturally have beauty between the mixing of the races, I'm sure you can have beauty socially too if we worked at it. You know, I don't think this country will be destroyed by external forces, the Russians, the Chinese, North Korea. I don't think those forces are gonna be the bane of us. I think it's going to be ourselves and this racial intolerance. It's a cancer that's eating at this country. And right now we're at a moment, whether or not this moment becomes a significant movement in terms of eradicating racial intolerance and stuff like that, only time will tell. But we're at a moment that I didn't think I'd live to see, where you have young white people out in the streets, tearing down monuments and stuff like that. And I live in the village, and I've walked around in the village, and I've seen Black Lives Matter signs on white houses and stuff like that. I just don't want this to be a fad. You know, I don't want this to be sort of like the it for now, for 2020. And then as we move into 2021 through the rest of the decade of the 20s, that we see more of the same. You know, whites need to get over it. We will be a better society if they just let it go. You know what I mean? Just let it go. And that's what I don't understand. I just don't get it. Why is it so paramount for them to hold on to these racial ideologies that sort of like prevent the United States from being the greatest country on earth? Right now, we're sort of like a laughing stock in terms of what happened to George Floyd, what happened to Breonna Taylor, and all these other people. And so we can't lead. You know, this idea of America being exceptional and stuff like that, we're exceptional at the worst things. We are exceptional at police killing its citizenry. We're exceptional at poverty. We're exceptional in terms of poverty levels. We're exceptional in all of these kinds of things that we ought not to be exceptional about. You know what I mean? And so that I don't understand it. I'm sick of it. I'll be 65 in 7 months, and so I've lived my whole life having to deal with this stuff. My grandmother was born in 1906, 41 years from the 15th Amendment that freed you know, freed slaves for just 41 years. And so I'm not that far removed from in terms of my lineage and stuff like that. My grandmother was probably about two generations from slavery. But I'm just saying, like, when will it end? Like, it just, I'm sick of it. It just doesn't make any sense. That's what I don't understand. It's just, we need to let it go.
Mm-hmm. And, Kevin, from the perspective of a white man, what do you not understand about African Americans?
Well, let me just first say you guys couldn't see me emphatically nodding my head to everything Ron was saying there. very, very much agree with those sentiments. And I think, you know, my misunderstandings about African Americans was really, you know, I was raised to be as empathetic as possible. And I think it is still a challenge for me to put myself in the shoes of African Americans, especially African American men. You know, just understanding that feeling of worrying about your safety, worrying about what obstacles your career is going to run into, seeing generation after generation of societal infrastructure that pushes back against you. I think, yeah, where my misunderstanding comes from is knowing what that experience feels like. And, you know, something that I wanted to make sure that I mention on this and in this conversation with the two of you is, you know, I would call myself racist. And I think any white person who says they are not is lying. And I think, you know, if there is a spectrum of 0 to 100, maybe I'm still in the 30s and it's something that I'm working on to fix. But there are so many norms that I grew up in from entertainment media and news media that, you know, inadvertently has me associate black people with poverty or with violence and things like that. And that leads to unconscious choices I make that do no one any good, even if it's for me or my business. Everyone ends up losing with those sort of things. So I think recent events, as well as just how I've changed in my professional and personal experiences over the last few years, have helped me take an outsider's look in on the way I perceive things and realize I've got a lot of work to do. So that all leads back into not understanding that experience of African Americans and, you know, what moves I can make to better do so.
And Kevin, you said you're from West Seneca. Are you living in the city now?
I live in the same neighborhood as Ron, in the Elma Village, yep.
Oh, as I do, too.
Oh, you live around the corner from me.
I've seen you outside of there, then.
Yeah, I do a lot of walking. I walk all of the west side, 10,
okay.
12 miles. I do a lot of walking. And I walk sometimes, and I'd be afraid, to be honest. And I walk in the daytime. It's just the neighborhood. I walk, like, Niagara Street up to Sheridan, over to sometimes I go to Elmwood, sometimes I go to Delaware. But just walking in those neighborhoods, a black lone male, and that's just a function of just being a black man in America. Probably nobody has any intention of doing me any harm. But as a black male in society, you always have to have your guard up. You can never go anywhere in this country and just feel safe. You know, I don't go to bed at night without turning my alarm on, even though I live in the village, which is a pretty safe area. We all do. But Kevin, for example, might not go to bed. He might sleep with his windows open, his door locked, who knows? But I don't do any of that. I say to my wife, before we go to bed, if she's the last, I said, did you secure the house? And see, these are the kinds of daily humiliations and indignities that black people go through that no one knows anything about. You know, they don't understand that, you know, we go to bed afraid sometimes just because we're black. And I think that while the police killing sensationalized the horrific indignities and humiliations, what we go through on a daily basis, people don't understand. You have no idea. having to have the talk with not only your sons, but you have to have the talk with your daughters too, because racial hatred and intolerance doesn't allow for gender distinction when it comes to treating people of color inhumanely. So it's rough, man, and it's just sad. You know, I got my first grandchild on the way in October, and you have reservations about bringing a child into a world that's the way this country is. A country where the president on yesterday tweeted a video where the white guy hollers white power, and he doesn't take it down for 3 hours. He doesn't take it down for 3 hours. He said he didn't see it or he didn't hear it. But he knows what he's doing. So we have a leader who perpetuates racial intolerance on a grand scale. And so, you know, that's why I say it's a moment. We got a moment right now. But whether or not this moment becomes a movement is a whole different ballgame.
And Kevin, the city of Buffalo remains one of the most racially segregated cities in the country. What does this city need to do to become more racially harmonious or progressive?
Buffalo, it's a tough example, right? Because we are a poor city, like plain and simple, it's a poor city. We have some wealthy suburbs. We can point to a few wealthy pockets in the city, but we're poor, all things considered. And you throw in the fact, even, you know, it seems silly, but the fact that our sports teams can never win, and you create this losing mentality, and I think that affects people's identity, and most importantly, I think it creates this feeling of a shrinking pie. And what I believe I see in Buffalo is that people, you know, will tend to work hard for themselves, their family, and we sort of slip into keeping that as our primary focus. And if there's this, you know, shrinking pie, you sort of have a zero-sum game, and you think that someone else's gains might be your loss. So I think it allows people to sort of lazily say, like, you know, I'm not doing deliberate harm to anyone else, therefore I'm being a good person, and that's all I really need to do. And in terms of Buffalo, in terms of a lot of cities in this country, I just wonder, like, when did that become our measuring stick? When did so many of us, religious or not, you know, think that you can make a few donations here and there, and otherwise, if you're just minding your own business, then that's enough for society to move forward? I think Buffalo needs to shake that off, and it's becoming just pure cliche, this city of good neighbors. I think all it really means is that if somebody's stuck in the snow in front of you, they'll push you out, and often we don't go any further. I think we need to rethink what that means, and if we want to become a viable, economically viable region, you know, we need to put these differences aside. Like Ron, I'm so tired of it. There's like this, you know, feeling of we need some sort of a hierarchy. So even in a poor city, we can look down on somebody else. And in doing that, you don't take the time to get to know those people, those individuals, and break down those feelings of fear, develop those feelings of empathy, work together, collaborate, support each other, and we get a stronger Buffalo out of it. I think, you know, even if you can't change people's hearts right off the bat by telling them to get over this racism, you might be able to pull them in on the idea of a diverse economy, meaning a fatter wallet for everybody else. So I don't know. I think we need to tear down a lot of the walls we have. And what are we, the sixth most segregated city in the country? And I think that starts with storytelling. It starts with conversations like this. I think the work WBFO does, the work RISE is trying to do, we need to humanize each other. We need to talk about individuals and not put stereotypes as groups. That's going to start breaking down fear. And with less fear, there's more collaboration. And with that, we're going to see a better city. And we can point to it as proof that once we stopped being so divisive with one another, things really started going this city's way. And again, that can be said for the whole country. We all want this COVID moment to go away and be done with. But, you know, we're allowing Black and brown people to be affected the worst by it. And now we see that we can't just ignore that. The numbers are spiking all over again. There's so little common sense in the way we are treating each other right now and sitting back scratching our heads as to why things aren't going better as a city and a region. So I don't know. I don't have a great answer for that, but I would just say that, you know, you get one shot at this. And if you're going to spend your entire life in fear and in anger rather than in love, in empathy, and collaboration, you know, what's the point then?
Let me piggyback on something Kevin said. You know, I was thinking, like, we have departments of sanitation. We have departments of in city government, and county government, state government. We have all of these different agencies that service human needs. One need that needs to be serviced that we don't have any institutional structures, and this idea of racial harmony. We need a department of racial harmony that can their charge would be to foster racial togetherness, love and support of each other. As Kevin alluded to, there are so many things going on in our society right now, COVID-19, you know, inadequate health care, inadequate housing, you name it. And if we could be coming together, and I think what detracts us from addressing all of those concerns, because all of those issues transcends race and gender. You got poor women, you got poor men, you got poor whites, you got poor non-whites. But the hegemony of race and racial intolerance take away from us being able to fix our society. And until we can, like, I really like, and I thought it was something to it, when South Africa had the truth and reconciliation going on when apartheid ended. We need our truth and reconciliation even in this country. You know, the horrors of slavery, you know, the sexual barbarity that was inflicted upon women, barbarism and stuff like that. We've never talked about that. I teach a course on the Black family, and I hit it so hard. You know, I don't you know, on the plantations you had little blue-eyed, curly-haired slave children. But because they were biracial, their masters was engaging in sex with their own daughters because they were slaves. We hadn't talked about these kinds of things. And the atrocities, the sexual atrocities that were also inflicted upon Black men, we hadn't talked about that. And we need to have a truth and reconciliation. That will be a start in terms of fixing what we need to fix. I'm not on the reparation wagon. I mean, I don't know how you would do that. I don't know, if you want to make free college tuition for Blacks for 20 years, 50 years, maybe something like that, but giving someone some money for something that happened 200 years ago, I don't know about that. But I do think that we can begin to redress the trauma that we all, people of color, Blacks, I know, we live with it every day. And we're continually being traumatized when we see what happened to George Floyd and stuff like that. And so I'm not so pessimistic as to believe that we can't do better as a society. You know, I just think that we just got to be real. We got to create this Department of Racial Harmony at maybe the federal level. That'd be a cabinet level position. You appoint a racial czar, if you will, a committee of people, and their sole task would be to address racial intolerance wherever it rears its ugly face. Sounds utopian, but it's something.
So we are at the end of this. I want to thank you again for your time, both of you. Any parting words before we part ways?
Kevin, you go first. I started off. You go first.
Oh, I was just going to pass the mic right back to you and let you have the parting words, Ron. Thank you.
Well, you know, like, I do think that we will be a better society when all of us remove the racial chip off of our shoulders. I applaud Kevin for acknowledging that he may harbor some racial views and stuff like that. And I do too. And I don't think that black people should think that we are immune to harboring racial animus towards others. And I think that that's a misconception. My mother, when I was brought up in the South, my mother raised all of us to never trust a white person. Zero. Never trust a white person. And I felt that way until I was in my early 20s. And I went off to Ohio State, and I had a racial event. I experienced discrimination at the departmental level. And many of the white students in my graduate cohort came to my support when some blacks didn't. And that's when I realized that you can trust white people. So we all have to look introspectively at ourselves and what we can do to become better people as it refers to race, as it relates to race. We all can do something in terms of improving ourselves. And then if you improve the collectivity, then I think as a whole, all of us, then I think society would be a much better place.